There is so much that goes into one bottle of wine. So much time, so many resources, so much careful thought.
This big body of water, Lake Michigan, it has so much love to give us.
I was the young generation, now I'm the old one. It's funny how that happens, you know?
I'm adverse to publications of wine to some degree because the people that are writing these articles are living in a vacuum.
Americans have embraced wine more. We've become more of a wine culture.
We say, so drink the wine. That's kind of our motto here at Life Between the Vines. One of the cool things about wine, besides drinking it, is the people you drink it with. And the stories you hear and tell with wine all come together to make every bottle unique. Discovering and tasting wine shouldn't be a homework assignment. And we believe that the people who are closest to wine have the best stories. So open a bottle.
And welcome to podcast number 316. This week we feature Stephanie Honig of Honig Vineyard and Winery in Napa Valley. As you've likely discovered, wineries produce and bottle several different varietals, while some specifically focus on what they're best at. Honig Vineyard and Winery produces exceptional Cabernet Sauvignon and Sauvignon Blanc, and a rosé. That's pretty much it. But in Napa Valley, Cab is king. After meeting her several years ago, we finally got together with Stephanie Honig at the winery during Premier Week. It's a funny thing, but most wine people have a real interesting background, and Stephanie is no different. We had a great chat, and as it turns out, a couple of things in common. Well, it's been a long time coming, but I'm here with Stephanie Honig, and we are at the winery right now. Honig Vineyard and Winery.
Yep.
So it's great to see you.
Great to see you too. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me. We met several years ago. I think we both agreed it was at auction, mm-hmm. at the barrel auction, and it was kind of like, we need to do this, and now we've done it.
Yeah, it just took a little while, but we made it happen.
Yes, we did. First of all, what is your title here at the winery?
I wear a lot of hats, but my main responsibilities are export. I do national sales, and I do PR, communications. Sales and PR are my main functions.
And your husband is owner of the winery?
So my husband is third generation, and he's been running the business for 35 years. His grandfather, Louis Honig, purchased this property in 1964.
Wow.
He was in the advertising business. He had an advertising firm in San Francisco. He purchased the property because he was enamored with the wine business and had a dream of someday retiring and making wine. Unfortunately, he passed away in the mid-70s, so he never got to do that. And my father-in-law, mother-in-law, and Michael's aunt and uncle, my husband's aunt and uncle, inherited the property. They founded the winery and decided to make a wine in their father's honor. So in 1980, they hired a gentleman to get the winery up and running because they had different careers and weren't really involved in the wine business at all, and founded the business in 1980. This gentleman started making just one wine, a Sauvignon Blanc, and a couple years into that, they realized that he knew how to make wine but didn't know how to sell or market wine. So they were struggling, and Michael is the oldest of the four siblings, and he had grown up in San Francisco but spent his weekends and summers coming to Rutherford. He felt that if the property sold, they would never be able to afford as a family to buy it again. So he asked his dad if he could leave college at the age of 21 and try to make the business work and keep it in the family. And his dad said, go for it. So he started selling in 1983, started selling door-to-door Sauvignon Blanc in restaurants in San Francisco, telling people why they should have a Sauvignon Blanc on their wine list and why it should be Honig. And every afternoon he'd go out and sell, and every morning he'd make his deliveries.
Wow.
And he did that for a solid 10 years, and then we started making Cabernet Sauvignon. But that's all we make, so we still continue to be. We've grown, obviously. We're in all 50 states now and in about 25 countries, but we continue to be family-owned, family-run, and only make Sauvignon Blanc and Cabernet Sauvignon.
Really? That's kind of interesting when you consider how many wineries expand to the point where they'll have as many as 30 different wines.
Mm-hmm.
Still, do you feel in any way that you're losing any opportunities by not going beyond that?
No, the focus really works for us. We, you know, we are in Rutherford, so right in the geographic center of the Napa Valley, where Bordeaux varietals do best. So Sauvignon Blanc and Cabernet Sauvignon are at their best here. There are other producers that make amazing Chardonnays, amazing Syrahs, amazing Rieslings. We specialize in what grows best here.
Sure.
Our winemaker loves it because she could focus on making the best Sauvignon Blanc and the best Cabernet every year, and she's not pulled making 13 different varietals. From a distribution standpoint, it works because our distributors know what's in stock and what's available, and it doesn't confuse them. So it works. It works from a quality standpoint, from a management standpoint, the focus. We like it. Now, Michael always says, if you ever see a Honig Chardonnay in the market, you'll know I've died.
Well, that's a tell.
Yeah.
That's an interesting
point. We didn't know that the kids will do, fourth generation might, but right now, yeah, they're still young.
So. And we were talking about, you had four kids?
We have four kids.
And ages, what are you talking about?
11, 10, 8 tomorrow, and 4.
So we're not quite up to the point where they're ready to start making wine and selling it.
No, we do have nieces and nephews that are older. Yeah, so one of them is involved with the winery, with the wine club right now. But our kids are still young.
So you and I were talking a moment ago. We ran into each other last year over at the Rutherford Grill. Mm-hmm. And you're with Chip Cassidy, and I traveled to Italy with Chip and a group of other people. So you were saying that he was pretty much responsible for your getting into wine. Tell me about that.
Yeah, he was my mentor and the reason I got into the wine business. So I grew up in Buenos Aires, and then I went to college in South Florida, and I ended up in a wine class as an elective, and my professor was Chip Cassidy, who at the time was a part-time professor at Florida International University and also the wine director at Crown Wine and Spirits that had 25 stores in South Florida. So after taking his class, I just really fell in love with the business, and he had this passion about it that was contagious, and I became his teaching assistant, and then I went to intern at one of the stores, and then he got me to learn, you know, he'd make me sit down and read and follow him around and listen to stories and meet with distributor sales reps with them, and he really got me excited and engaged in the business.
You were very lucky.
I was very, very lucky.
You couldn't have asked for a better mentor.
Yeah, no, I'm very lucky, and I adore him. Yeah.
I love seeing the smile on your face when you talk about
him. Yeah, no, he's cool. The best, yeah.
So you're from Buenos Aires originally?
Born in Philadelphia.
Oh, okay.
Grew up in Buenos Aires. My mom's from Buenos Aires.
Okay. Was it just simply you moved back down there when you were young?
I was 6 when my mom decided to move back.
That's kind of interesting. And when did you come to the States for school?
I came back to the States, yes, when I was 19, moved to Florida for college.
That had to be a big culture shock for you at that age, I would imagine.
Yeah, it was, but I had family in both places, so I'd come back and forth a lot.
Well, it's not a bad place to travel to.
No.
Nothing wrong with that at all.
No, and we take our kids back to Argentina every year to visit families.
So. That's nice. Yeah. And do you spend time drinking wine when you're down there?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. Yeah, there's some great wines down there.
No, there's some fabulous wines, yeah. Is it, I kind of wonder, just being a winemaker, being in the business, what that's like for you to tour any of the wineries down there? I mean, do you find yourself being judgmental, or do you find yourself being curious? I mean, what's that experience like for you?
Yeah, I'm curious. But, you know, I grew up in Buenos Aires, which is, you know, a big city. But I have visited Mendoza. I used to make a wine in Salta, in Cafayate.
Really?
Yes. I'm trying to remember what year. 04, 05, 06, 07. I made a Torrontes, a white wine. So I'm more familiar with that area. And it's very rustic. It's kind of what I would imagine Napa Valley being 50 years ago.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool. But I mean, any particular reason why you stopped making wine there?
Because I started having kids, and I got more involved in Honig. I've been involved in Honig since 06, but I got more involved in Honig, and I had to choose where to focus. And the other brand, the Torrontes brand was a partnership with a winery in Salta, which great family, but I could only do so much and be in the market so much.
And be a mom.
And be a mom.
Yeah, that's the real challenge right there.
Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of stuff going on.
Yeah. Yeah.
How many cases are you doing here? Just to get an idea of your size.
We're about 60 to 70,000 cases, depending on the year. So we're, for Napa Valley, a good size. I'd say medium plus size. In the context of the world, not very big. But for Napa Valley, we're a good size winery, medium plus.
Sure. Well, being that you're, part of your job is being in PR amongst 42 other things and being a mom and, of course, being part of the family. Do you ever run into a situation where, it's a question I've been asking a lot of winemakers, the question you don't get asked, that you'd like to be asked?
Well, I guess, you know, something that I started to do that Michael wasn't focusing on when we got married in 2006 and I came to the family was export. So he always focused on selling everything domestically because it was easier and cheaper and he could sell everything domestically. And my point to him was we're a generational business. The world is getting smaller. We want this business to be, and the brand to have value for the fourth generation. So it's important to be global. And he said, fine, do it. So I picked up the phone and started finding different importers in various markets to sell the wine to. And now we're in 25 different countries and it's so much fun. I just love the whole global aspect of working with the wines and showing up in Manila, right? And doing and meeting with people that know the wines. I was in Turks and Caicos last month and the somm at the restaurant was like, oh, I used to sell your wine in Singapore. And I'm like, oh my gosh, it goes around the world. So it's like, wow, we can be a global brand. So that's something that really makes me proud. And it's something I work on hard.
It sounds like you really had a hunger for that before you started doing it.
Yeah, well, it's exciting, you know, to see different. It's hard because you don't speak the language and you're removed from these markets and you can only visit the same market once every 2 or 3 years because you can only be in so many places. So it's not like you can go back to New York 2 or 3 times a year and build up relationships. It's much harder.
Well, the idea of exporting, I mean, the fact that you already have kind of an international background gives you a qualification. And the fact you speak a different language, I don't know if you speak other languages, but it just gives you a bit more of an understanding than the average person does.
Right.
That makes a great deal of difference.
Right. Now I can get by in Latin language, Italian, French, Portuguese, but I can't speak any Asian languages.
No, well, that's a bit of a...
right.
It's a horse of a different color.
Skilled.
No, I think most of us would be challenged when it comes to that. Although
right.
I've met people who do, and it's pretty fascinating when you talk to them. This is kind of, again, a general question, but... what drives you crazy about the business? Now, that could be good or bad. What makes you crazy passionate? What makes you crazy, geez, I wish they'd stop doing that?
I mean, it's a really fun business because the product is really fun. You know, you're not selling widgets. You're selling something that people get excited about and are happy to be around. And so I love that. I love that it drives me crazy and I love it that both, that it's such a vertically integrated business. You know, it's very rare, or I can't think of another industry where you manufacture, right? You grow, you manufacture, you market, you sell, you know, you go all the way through. Usually you do one or the other, right? You're either a marketing company or a distribution company or a sales company or an ag. And the fact that people forget sometimes that we don't grow bottles on our vines, that we're growing grapes and we're making it and then we're cellaring it for 1, 2, 3 years and then we're selling it is adds to a lot of the magic of it and the uniqueness of the industry. But it's also, can make you crazy because you're dealing with so many variables.
Sure. There is no other business. We've talked about this with other winemakers too, but there's another parallel to being a winemaker in terms of craziness is you're one of the only businesses that lives in the past. You live in the present and you live in the future.
Right.
That's really nutty.
Mm-hmm. It's true. So you're planning for, releasing a wine 3, 4 years from now. And it's very capital intensive too. So right now, we're getting ready to harvest, in a few months, our 19s, 2019, but we're selling our 15 cab. So we own part of our 15 inventory, our 16, our 17, our 18, and we're getting ready to harvest 19.
Wow.
So it's fascinating, but it's very complex.
Yeah. Have you ever taken the time where you, to be in the vineyard, to be part of that process in the cellar, just to, you know, sort of have that feel for things?
Yeah, I've spent time with Kristen. Kristen Belair is our winemaker. She's been with us for 21 years. And she and her team do an amazing job. I mean, I've shadowed her. I've tasted with her. I've learned from her. And I studied some viticulture before marrying my goal, studying for my WSET, my Master Wine Program. But I don't do the... No, the production team's amazing. And they make the wine. And I'm more on the front end doing sales and marketing.
And how far have you gone with the...
I finished my diploma. I don't think they call it diploma anymore, so I don't know what it's called.
Certification?
Now. Yeah, whatever. I forget what... I want to say it's level 3.
Levels. You're right. Levels.
Right? So it's whatever is before MW, the one below that. And I finished that in 2004, so I know it's changed.
That's a bit of a challenge. Did you do it when you had kids?
No, before kids.
Oh, okay, good.
No. That, yeah, I'm glad I got
There's
it.
There's no way you could have done that.
I got it in before that.
Oh, my God. You would have lost your mind.
Yeah, no.
Or your kids would have hated you.
No.
Something
no.
like that.
Yeah. I can't. Yeah.
But that had to be quite an experience to go through that, regardless of being in the business or not.
I was in the business then, but I was working in New York. So I was working with Viv Clico in New York. And no, I learned a lot. I mean, I didn't go in thinking I would ever be a master wine, but I wanted to learn... you know, I was selling Italian wines and Burgundian wines and just wines from all over Bordeaux, and I was champagne, and I wanted to have more knowledge and confidence to speak of all these different wines.
Sure. It's talking the talk and walking the walk as well. Yeah, interesting. About how much of your wine are you exporting?
I mean, it was up this year, but we were still at about 5% of our production, so still a very small number. Our leading market is Japan. Our second largest market is Canada.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow, interesting.
And then we sell a little bit in a lot of places, a little bit in India. Turks and Caicos is actually a good market for us. A little bit in Mexico, Philippines, Singapore, China, Hong Kong.
Now, what was your first vintage again? What year?
The first vintage for the winery was 1980.
Okay.
Yeah.
Always makes me a little bit curious about this idea of when people do library tastings, and maybe this is a secret, but how much do you actually hold back from a given vintage? Of course, you're doing more wine than a lot of wineries around here, but it fascinates me to think somewhere, somehow, you have some wine hidden away.
Unfortunately, not very much. When I married Michael, I asked him that same question, and he's like, no, I don't keep it, I sell it. So we had to do, I want to say it was Wine Spectator, I can't remember. I think it was Wine Spectator that emailed, and I think it was 2012, and they said, we're doing a prospective tasting. We want 2 bottles of your O2s. And I looked everywhere. I asked every family member. I looked. There were not 2 bottles of O2s. Oh, geez. They sold it all.
Oh, that's sad.
So, so after 06, when we're selling 04s, so 03s, 04s, we started saving more, but we save maybe 20 to 30 cases every year. So it's not a huge amount, but it's something, right? So if we have an event or something, we can pull out those bottles.
Yeah, so you have sort of a program now.
Right.
Yeah. It's just interesting to think about that, because it is going back on and this idea of living in the past, but also, of course, seeing how your bottles age, and that's a big deal.
Yeah, seeing it. Yeah, and we have had, you know, we have had wines from the mid-late 80s that we found and consumed in the 90s, and we just find them. They're not necessarily stored, but they taste really good.
Yeah.
So, but it's good to, definitely, it's good to have those bottles to pull out later. For reds, we don't store the whites.
Yeah,
for the
reds. I can understand that. Sure, yeah. Absolutely. So what do you like to drink?
I drink a lot of aromatic whites. Yeah, I drink... Sauvignon Blancs, Pinot Blancs, Pinot Gris, Rieslings, Sparkling, yeah, Gewürztraminer. Traminer. I mean, I'll drink anything. I drink Pinot Noir, I drink Cab Franc, I drink Cabernet. But if I'm opening a bottle for myself at home, I will 80% of the time pick an aromatic white.
So we're here at the winery, we're at the tasting room, and I'm assuming you're by appointment here, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because of our permits, we're by appointment only.
For people to make an appointment, I assume they could call, or would they go to your website, which is?
www.honigwine.com, or they can call 707-963-5618, extension 318.
Stephanie, this has been a real pleasure to sit down and finally talk to you after all this time. And, you know, you guys have a beautiful space here, and I hope people consider coming by here because it's a real cool place to come see.
Thank you so much. Thanks for coming. And, yeah, I hope we do this again soon.
I hope so, too. Cheers. Yeah,
thank you. Cheers.
Listen to Stephanie on our Vino Lingo segment, defining the wine term Honig. Learn more by visiting honigwine.com.
Thanks for listening, and remember to like us on Facebook. Also, check out our YouTube channel.
Life Between the Vines is produced at Fifth Floor Recording Company in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Produced and edited by Ray Pfister. Theme song and original music written and recorded by Tim Dondarevo. Additional original music by Ray Pfister. Our host is Kay Paskoff. Our graphics and website specialist is Lawton Hall. Our web geek is Dan Gieschen. Photos by Jeanette Herniak and Catherine Shearer. Copyright 2019.